Hi, everybody. How you doing?
Good.
Did we all find something good for lunch? Good, good, good. Okay, so I'll introduce myself. I'm Rachel Ferguson. I am a professor of philosophy at Lindenwood University, which is right over the Missouri River in St. Charles, if you're familiar. If you haven't been out to St. Charles recently, you should go. Things have really changed. Lindenwood is big now. It's wild. Beautiful Fine and Performing Arts Center, and we went NCAA, all kinds of exciting things. So at Lindenwood, I also run a center called the Liberty and Ethics Center, which is part of the Hammond Institute for Free Enterprise. And so you'll probably guess that my actual area of interest in philosophy is political and economic philosophy. However, I got to study, so you're wondering, why am I talking about imagination? I'm certainly no expert, so we'll just kind of create a kind of narrative here that'll give you some anchors in the history of philosophy to think about this stuff, but I am by no means an expert in epistemology or anything like that. But I did get to study under the wonderful Eleanor Stump at St. Louis University. If you're not familiar with Eleanor Stump, she wrote the Oxford Companion to St. Thomas Aquinas, and she's an absolute genius, and she also wrote a book called Wandering in the Darkness, which is her work on the problem of evil. It's very important, and also something, if you're a Christian, and of course you're welcome to be here if you're not, but if you are a Christian, she does something very unusual in that book, which she's certainly a philosopher, and she's doing philosophy, but she uses Bible stories in order to address the problem of evil. Abraham and Isaac, Samson, Mary and Martha. It's really a totally innovative approach, and one she had to defend in her choice to use it. But she's world-renowned, really wonderful. And the reason I mention her is because I took a course with her that dealt with the relationship between Thomas Aquinas and Dante. Dante was a Thomist, and he was basing the whole poem really on his notion of the cosmos that he gets from Aristotle and Thomas, but also of the human person and virtue and vice. And so we'll kind of end with that as we get started. But what I'm hoping to do is talk to you all, not just talk, right, but get your participation. So let me just get a little sense, like, how many of you are kind of into philosophy? Like, you sort of remember your classes? Oh, that's great, like most of you. Okay, you guys, you probably know more than me. Okay. Which is fine. I'm no problem. So this will be great, because what we're going to do is kind of review a little bit in order to think about the way that the term imagination is used and the way that images are thought of in different approaches to philosophy. Okay? And this is a workshop, so we're going to do a lot of interaction. All right, and I have one of my former students here, Jacob. So don't answer all the questions, Jacob. Give somebody else a chance. All right. So first, you know where we've got to start. And I've got to remember, don't remember what my first, oh, there it is. Okay, don't look at that. All right. Let's review Plato's cave, right? We all remember the allegory of the cave. And this is very important because, of course, this is where we see the term imagination appearing in the history of philosophy. Okay, So somebody just kind of describe the situation. This is from Plato's Republic. It's a kind of metaphor. It's an allegory that he's using to describe the way that we know things. And what is the situation in the cave? Go ahead. Remember, this is interactive, so just jump right in. Or raise your hand and I'll call on you. Okay, go ahead.
You're basically most of, or all of humanity is inside the cave and mm-hmm. looking at reflections on the cave wall of the real. And so all humanity is seeing is shadows.
Yeah. So they're kind of silhouettes, right? Silhouettes. We find out later, how do we find out that the silhouettes are being projected onto the cave wall? Does anybody remember this part? Yeah, there's a fire, and then there's people. Yeah, they're sort of carrying things in front of the fire so that you're getting a silhouette, right? So this is sort of the mechanics of what's happening in the cave. And this is all of us. It doesn't sound very good, does it? Okay. So what are we looking at on the wall? We're looking at an image. It's an image. And it's not even an image of real things. I mean, you even said of the real, but it's not exactly an image of real things, because what happens when someone breaks free? We have no explanation, by the way, for how they broke free, which I think reflects Plato's puzzlement at how Socrates existed, right? He doesn't, where did that guy come from? Where did he get his ideas? I don't know. But what happens when someone breaks free? Does anybody remember?
They're offered the intriguing philosophical question of do I stay with what I now know is real and pure and good, or do I turn and go back to the cave and try to bring people out with me?
Because if I break out of the chains so that I'm not just headed towards the wall, right? At the images. Don't forget images, because this is what he calls imagination. So when we're perceiving things in this world, that's what Plato calls imagination. That's really what we would call perception. Okay, so if I turn around, and I'm going to skip the part about who's holding the artifacts, because we're coming back to that, but that's a very good point. But let's say I discover that that's the case. I see the light, right, of the hole to get out of the cave. What happens when I come out of the cave? It is rough. Has anybody gone to a movie in the middle of the day? And you, like, forget it's daytime, right? You ever do that? And then you come out, and you're like, ah! You know? Okay, you come out, and what happens? Your eyes are crying from the brightness of the sun. Imagine if you were living in a cave always. I mean, that would be, your eyes would not be able to adjust. So at first, you're thinking, I don't know more, I know less, right? So at first, you're really disoriented. And then as your eyes adjust, if you stick with it, I always say to my students, Plato understands your struggle. You know, when they read philosophy, he knows it's painful, right? We think in concrete terms, and now we're talking about abstracts. Okay, he knows this. You just have to stick with it. Okay, so they stick with it, and then now we're seeing the really real. And then they've got to decide, do I stay up here or go down? Okay. It's tempting to go back down where at least I can see things, you know, shadowy. Up here, I'm blinded by the light. But you have to wait. So here's the picture there, right? So you've got people holding some kind of items, casting the shadow onto the wall, and all of us sitting there chained to that perspective. Okay. When you come out of the cave into the really real world, what is that a metaphor for in Plato? Does anybody remember? What are those really real things called in Plato's philosophy? The forms, right? The forms, or the ideas, capital I. Okay? And the reason Plato thinks this is because he actually follows Heraclitus, or as my students say, Pocahontas, because they put a Heraclitus quote in the Disney movie, and so now they think it's Pocahontas who said this. You can never step in the same river twice. Okay? It was Heraclitus, not Pocahontas. I'll die on that hill. No. What does that mean? You can never step in the same river twice. Why not? Let's hear from someone new. Just, yeah, there you go.
The water is constantly moving and changing, so when you step back in, it's a different water, different rocks have changed from the
yeah.
flow over.
This thing is constantly in flux, right? That's not really the same river. The river isn't something static. It's something dynamic. It's always changing. And Heraclitus is saying, look, this is material reality. It's in constant flux. You can't pin it down. Things are coming into being and then decaying and going out of being all the time. So what is it to know that world? That's not knowledge, right? You need to know something that's eternal, something that lasts. These are the forms. So what are some of the forms or the ideas that Plato discusses in his dialogues? What's he interested in? What's the Republic about? The form of, you can do this
justice.
One. Justice. Jacob's looking like this. You can say it. The form of justice, right? In the Euthyphro, what's he talking about? He says to Euthyphro, Socrates says, why are you suing your father? Because it's
pious.
It's the holy thing to do. What is holiness, he says. Right? So you have to talk about what is the form of that, okay? In the Symposium, as they're all drunk around the table, talking about love, right? That's right. And you get the famous soulmate joke by Aristophanes. I always like to remind my students that it was a joke. The comedian was the one telling the story about the soulmate. It's not real. Just, you can be perfectly happy with a lot of different people. Just pick one and stick with them, okay? All right. So Plato is interested in those things because he believes that they won't change. There's something worthy of knowing. You can actually know something if you know those. Number is what he's really obsessed with. By the end of his life, he's completely obsessed with number and form. And the experience of those truths is direct. It's almost mystical, actually. It's almost very hard to explain. And many Christians saw Plato as a forerunner of the faith. They actually argued that he was like preparing, you know, the Greek and Roman world in some sense for the faith, because here's a guy who believes in the form of goodness, this ultimate thing called goodness, which sure sounds like God, sort of, right? And he also believes in the survival of the soul through death, right? The persistence of the soul through death. And so it looks like that's a good fit. And so many of the Christian philosophers during the early medieval period are Platonists, okay? And so think about when you kind of have a picture in your mind of the history of philosophy, you've got the Greeks, right? They're 400 years before Christ. The Romans weren't super creative. Cicero was good, but there wasn't a lot going on there with philosophy. But then with Augustine, right, and then all the way up through, Aquinas really changes the scene, right? But from about 400 to 1200, you have a big sort of Platonic period there in Christian philosophy. What happens to art? This is an interesting question. So here you have all these Platonist Christians. Constantine converts. Well, what is classical art like? I mean, it's very detailed, right? I mean, think of the discus thrower. You know, every vein, every muscle. A real appreciation for the detail of the human form. What happens to art after Constantine becomes emperor? What happens? What are medieval images like?
Flat.
Yeah, flat. They go flat. They lose proportion. Right, they're disproportionate, and I'm trying to remember if I put one of these in here or not. No, that's Plato there. We're going to talk about him in a second, but that's Plato. So yes, so it goes flat, loses perspective. You'll notice that oftentimes the heads are large compared to the bodies, and also the eyes are very large in the face, right? And because that's the emphasis on the consciousness or the soul as the center of personhood, okay? And a de-emphasis on the body, right? Because for Plato, it's just this knowledge of the forms, right? And this return of the self to the realm of the forms. He even believes in reincarnation, right? Which means that my body has nothing to do with what it is to be me, because a soul can go in and out of different bodies, okay? And so my bodiliness or my embodiment is not part of myself for Plato. And it's a limitation. Just as in the cave, that's supposed to be us living in this world, right? We are limited by our empirical experiences. Okay, they're actually deceiving us or misleading us. So it's pretty negative when it comes to this world and physical reality and materiality and embodiment. Not great. All right, and so you see this in medieval art pretty clearly. I always think of the one in the Cathedral Basilica. Do you guys like the Cathedral Basilica? Does anybody go there? Beautiful. I mean, it's stunning, right? Jaw-dropping. But if you turn around, coming back from communion, if you turn around and there's the archway there, right, of coming up into heaven and going down into hell, great Dantean one, by the way, right, because hell is both on fire and icy, which we'll talk about. But Mary is up there, and she's real big, and her followers are praying to her, but they're real little, right? And so it's the spiritual significance of the person, right? So it's an idealism in art as opposed to a realism. So it's not that they didn't know that people are all the same size, right? But rather that they were just expressing something that's ideal in nature. Okay, good. So we've got kind of Plato's idea, right? Imagination. He's not excited about it. Okay, so I'm going to call Plato a rationalist. Let's talk about one more rationalist, Descartes. Okay, now we're jumping 2,000 years, basically, up to the 1600s. Okay, what's Descartes famous for? Well, okay, somebody raise your hand. I didn't hear what you said. Who said something? Go ahead. Cogito ergo sum. I think, right, cogitation? I think, therefore, ergo, I am. Okay, suicide, right? Sum, self. I think, therefore, I am. I always try to teach the students etymology as we go, right? Okay. Descartes is an interesting one. It's interesting, in the introduction to his Meditations, he laments about the fact that his teachers don't agree. I mean, they all believe in God, right? I mean, for God's sakes, they're all Catholic. You know, you'd think there'd be a lot of overlap in terms of the conclusions they come to philosophically, but there's not. And he can't understand this. You know, this is frustrating to him. It makes me want to do a personality analysis on him a little bit. But anyway, he doesn't like this at all. So what Descartes wants is certainty, right? He wants to be able to reestablish our philosophical views on a basis that is totally certain. And in order to achieve certainty, he has to find out what is indubitable, right? What is not doubtable. So he says something Augustine had already said. Augustine just didn't try to build a whole philosophical system on it. Okay, I think, therefore I am. All right, and so if I doubt everything in the whole world, I'm still doubting. Right? And so we know that I'm real. Okay. I don't want to go on and on about this because we have a lot to cover, but I want to say that I don't think that Descartes' project gets off the ground at all. I think it fails entirely. I'm drawing on the criticism of David Hume, who said that, hey, Descartes, if you're going to doubt mathematics, which he does, how do you get to use logic and make arguments? Aren't they just the same thing? Ones with numbers and ones with words? Right? Reasoning? And so if he's going to doubt everything, how come he doesn't doubt logic? But if you doubt logic, you can't make an argument. Right? And so it could be that Descartes' project doesn't even get off the ground. Also, Westerners, the self. I think, therefore I am. What is an I? I mean, we're assuming it, right? And this is what, I'm a David Hume scholar, and this is one of his critiques, right? He says, we sneak in our favorite assumptions, particularly Enlightenment thinkers. They love to do this. I've started over completely. I've depended on nothing and no one for my system. Ha ha ha. No, you haven't, right? You've snuck in your favorite assumptions. And one assumption is that there is such a thing as a self, right? An I that exists. I'm not a dream in the mind of Shiva. What is it to be an I? I mean, St. Augustine was the first person to write an autobiography, right? He was the first person to think it made any sense to tell the story of oneself. So the self is a deeply Christian notion, okay? The choosing thing, right? You can't just import that in and act like it's obvious. It's not obvious. Now, I'm not going to go on and critique the rest of Descartes' argument, but let's just say it didn't go well, okay? It didn't really hold up. He needs God to get everything else, and his argument for the existence of God is not very compelling. And so you end up with solipsism, right? Just me all by myself and you all, I'm dreaming you. So it's a lovely dream. Okay, but this is this method of radical doubt. And this desire for perfect certainty. So your epistemic standards, right? Let's think about this, right? In the ancient and the medieval world, I mean, Plato's got very high epistemic standards. You have to have this direct mystical knowledge of the forms to say you know anything. Everything else is opinion. Okay? But other than that, particularly with Aristotle, and we're going to get to him, epistemic standards are reasonable, right? You can have good reasons for saying you know something. You can't prove it. I mean, do my mother and father love me? It sure seems like it. I mean, I don't think it's an elaborate hoax, guys, you know, right? Can I prove it? No. I mean, I guess you could imagine, if I was going to use the method of radical doubt, I guess I could say that they were faking it, right? I mean, that's possible. But that would be a weird...
In the first place.
What'd you say?
If you have parents in the
right, right. Exactly. And so, you know, so what can we know if our epistemic standards are this high? Okay? I can be very certain that 2 plus 2 equals 4, but Aristotle said it is the mark of an educated man that he does not expect more precision from the discipline than it admits of. So mathematics has a certain level of precision. Ethics, perhaps, not as precise. Okay? Or not in every way. Okay, so, and Descartes gets us into trouble here, guys, because by the end of his system, he's got the mind and he's got the body, but he doesn't know how they interact. Right? This is the mind-body problem that Descartes sets up. Really, really difficult. People just hammering away at that problem. And I think the Enlightenment is, we can in some sense think of it as a kind of rationalist period in which everyone tries to succeed at what Descartes failed at. Okay, I'm making big sweeping generalizations here. All right, but I'm going to talk about the Scottish Enlightenment, guys, because they're different. But the Cartesian Enlightenment. Okay, so rationalism. Not super excited about our perceptions and the kind of knowledge that our perceptions can give us. And I'm thinking of the term there, image, right? Imagination. My connection to physical reality. All right, let's jump to this guy because we're going to look at the reaction. So if we want to call these guys rationalists, let's talk about the sentimentalists or the romanticists, right? The romantics. And this is Rousseau, handsome guy. Handsome guy. And he's pictured. You can see he's pictured here in nature. Okay, very appropriate for Rousseau, Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Have you guys heard of Jean-Jacques Rousseau? Yeah. Has anyone read the Discourse on the Origin of Inequality? It's a wild ride. I recommend you read it. It's very interesting. It would certainly help you understand Romanticism. Because what Rousseau wants to do is he wants to argue that there's a natural person that's very, very different from you and I, we civilized people. Does anybody know kind of the story he tells?
No, I don't.
Well, and he doesn't use that term, but people applied that term to his theory, the noble savage, and his description of early man, I guess, or natural man, let's call him, not particularly social. Actually, the children leave their mother when they're ridiculously young, and it's like 4 or something. They leave their mother and wander around in the forest. Social in the sense that if this man, a natural person, comes across a dying thing, it'll feel pity and compassion for it. So there's a kind of a little bit of a sympathetic reverberation there. But that's about it. I mean, the natural man doesn't really want to live together with other people. And his pity does make him avoid conflict. So Rousseau thinks that natural man is not violent, not seeking out, not warlike. What else? Kind of a benign self-regard. Okay, it's a sort of self-love that's non-destructive, he thinks. And then slowly culture begins to develop. Okay, so it's always the women's fault. It's us, ladies. It was our fault. Because we had these babies, and they needed care, and we wanted these guys to hang around and help us. Gosh darn it. You could have been free, men, but oh well. Okay, so we kind of tie these guys down. The whole hunter-gatherer thing turns into agriculture, and here's what happens with agriculture. Because if you're going to do agriculture, you're going to stay in one place, right? And somebody's going to say, hey, I planted this. You can't just take it, right? I planted it. I want to harvest it. Well, Rousseau questions that. Here's a quote. The first person who, having enclosed a plot of land, took it into his head to say, this is mine, and found people simple enough to believe him, was the true founder of civil society. What crimes, wars, murders... What miseries and horrors would the human race have been spared had someone pulled up the stakes or filled in the ditch and cried out to his fellow men, Do not listen to this imposter. You are lost if you forget that the fruits of the earth belong to all and the earth to no one. Okay. What'd you say?
Russian music.
Right. Okay, so now we start. What happens with society? Now I'm comparing myself to you. I'm drawing boundaries. Right? Now maybe I think I'm better than you or that you're better than me. I'm saying she's my wife or he's my husband, not yours. You can't have them. Right? And this is just the beginning of all the terrible emotions that go beyond that simple pity and compassion and benign self-regard that natural man had. Now we've got jealousy and envy and status-seeking, and right? And so it comes with civil society, okay? My favorite, I just have to say this quote, it's neither here nor there, but my favorite quote is, and I'm a big fan of breastfeeding, guys. I breastfed both of my sons. But I'm not sure that it has all of the potential that Rousseau thinks it has. He says, but let mothers deign to nurse their children. Morals will reform themselves. Nature's sentiments will be awakened in every heart. The state will be repeopled.
Amen.
Okay, I mean, it has some good effects, mostly having to do with allergies and things. I'm not sure what he's talking about. And so Rousseau ushers in this romantic sort of nature back. I don't want to say back to nature because he wants to compromise in some sense, right? He wants to get into these small communities. But he definitely has a romantic view of nature and that natural man is actually basically good, right? I mean, that's really what's at the heart of romanticism, is that people are basically good. It's civil society that corrupts them. It's civilization that corrupts them. And what we need to do is peel away the layers, all of this inauthenticity of civilization, right? And get back to that, not just let the child blossom, right? You say to the teacher, what are they going to be reading this year? Whatever they want to read. Okay? They'll just follow their bliss. All right? And so that's kind of the romantic view, okay? Who is this? So tell me if you recognize this. Knowing that nature never did betray the heart that loved her, 'tis her privilege, through all the years of this our life, to lead from joy to joy. For she can so inform the mind that is within us, so impress with quietness and beauty, and so feed with lofty thoughts that neither evil tongues, rash judgments, nor the sneers of selfish men, nor greetings where no kindness is, nor all the dreary intercourse of daily life, shall e'er prevail against us, or disturb our cheerful faith, that all which we behold is full of blessings.
Thomas Kincaid.
William Wordsworth. Right. That's Wordsworth. It's lovely. I mean, it's beautiful, right? John Stuart Mill had a terrible nervous breakdown when he was in his early 20s. His father's very rationalist utilitarianism had just crushed him. And he said it was the romantic poetry of Wordsworth that freed him from his depression. Right? I mean, it's really a lovely idea. But let's challenge it. Here's another one. Tell me if you know who this is. Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forests of the night. What immortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry? In what distant deeps or skies burnt the fire of thine eyes? On what wings dare he aspire? What the hand dare seize the fire? And what shoulder and what art could twist the sinews of thy heart? And when thy heart began to beat, what dread hand and what dread feet? What the hammer? What the chain? In what furnace was thy brain? What the anvil? What dread grasp dare its deadly terrors clasp? When the stars threw down their spears and watered heaven with their tears, did he smile his work to see? Did he who made the lamb make thee? Tiger, tiger, burning bright, in the forests of the night, what immortal hand or eye dare frame thy fearful symmetry? William Blake, right? You said it. Okay, so if you're sitting in the English countryside watching the sheep frolic, it sure seems like you could learn morality from nature. But not necessarily if you're in the jungles. Watching animals tear each other apart. Bloated corpses are natural too, right? My professor, Dr. Charon, used to kid because people would say to him, I'm going to go to the botanical gardens and spend time in nature. He said, that's not nature, that's high art. Right? Okay, so interestingly, both even though I'm calling Plato a rationalist and Rousseau a romanticist, they come to similarly utopian conclusions, which I think is really interesting. Man does not choose evil, but is merely badly educated by his society. I mean, this is exactly what Plato thinks as well, right? He says that we simply misperceive the good. We're not evil, we're mistaken, right? And we don't need to be punished, we need to be educated. Okay, this is Plato's view. Plato is famously suspicious of art. Do we know his views on art?
Kick the poets out of the city, get them out.
Yeah, they're corrupting. I mean, listen, if I'm deceived by what I'm perceiving in nature, surely I'm doubly perceived if someone's imitating nature. Right now it's an imitation of an imitation of the really real world of the forms. That's not good. Okay? And he wants to have state-planned kind of art or something. All right. Let's see, Rousseau, I mean, his parallel, and this is why I wanted to come back to your point about the people holding the items here. We can see them here. For Rousseau, this is civilization, right? We're being presented, you're raised in a certain way and you're told, this is good, this is bad, right? You're supposed to hold your fork like this, send an RSVP within a week, you know, send a thank you note, etc. And so he doesn't really trust that either. Aren't we being fake when we use good manners? We see people according to their status instead of as who they really are. He was also against theater. Rousseau, at least in most places, he didn't want the theater. He certainly didn't want it in Geneva. And he didn't like the way people acted. He felt that you watch actors, then you become an actor. You know, you're acting. You're not being authentic. Makeup, adornment, he didn't like any of that. It was immodest and fake. Okay. Anybody read Emile? Yeah, some of you maybe if you have an education, right? It's a very famous book in education. Rousseau wrote about a perfect education. Emile has to be brought up. Do you want to tell us? How was he brought up? 20 years ago. Well, it's not in this society, right? I mean, Emile has to be carted off to a farm in order to be raised correctly, away from everyone. He can't even know about our reality. It's kind of like The Village, you know, that M. Night Shyamalan, right? We're going to purify, you know, our children by taking them out to some sort of created society. And so humans are perfectible if their environment can simply be constructed along the correct lines in order to rid them of the constant deception and competition that dogs all human civilizations so far. And of course, my favorite thing is that Plato wants the philosophers in charge. That sounds like a good plan to me. And Rousseau declares, we will force them to be free. Okay. So what I would like to present is a third way. Are we excited that there's a third way? Good. Let's talk about the third way. And I need to move a little faster, guys, just so I can get through this. Okay, so there's a third way, and we're going to start with Aristotle. All right, so Aristotle says, I love my friends, but I love the truth more. Okay, so he's going to break with Plato. He breaks with his theory of the forms, his view of human nature, his intellectualist ethics. So Aristotle says, okay, yes, the material world is surely changing all the time. That's true. But if you plant an acorn, what are you going to get?
Oak tree.
Are you going to get a maple tree?
No.
So there's enough stability in this world, right? There's an underlying whatness to things, takon, the whatness or the substance of things. And the design will continue. Let's see if I've got Aristotle here. Okay, so you see here's Raphael's School of Athens. He snuck in Michelangelo there. He's always looking sad. So there's the School of Athens, and I honed in here on Plato and Aristotle. Plato, of course, is the older one. He's got the gray beard. And Aristotle was a student, but he left him, and he's pointing up, right, to the realm of the forms, the ethereal ideas, and Aristotle is pointing down to the material realm. He's saying, no, you can know things. Study the structure of an oak tree. The leaves have a certain shape, right? And they always come out that way. And you don't get maple syrup from an oak tree, right? There are lots of things you can learn. And in fact, Aristotle wrote a ton on zoology and many scientific areas. The theory of the forms oversimplifies things. The goodness of things is found in the things themselves, or the aspects of things are found in the things themselves. I'm going to jump a little bit. The big point about Aristotle for this conference is that he thinks that it is not possible for human beings to think without an image. And that's the real weakness. I mean, even if it were true about the forms, which he doesn't think it is, you couldn't know them anyway because they're totally abstract. And human beings are embodied beings. We think with images. Draw. What does Euclid say? Draw a circle. Right? I mean, literally, his postulates. To draw a straight line from any point to any point. To describe a circle with any center and distance. In fact, Jacob knows my trick on this one. Have you guys ever seen a circle? Have you? Raise your hand if you've seen a circle. It's a trick. You haven't seen a circle at all. Because a point is a thing with no width, no length, and no breadth. It has no part, Euclid says, right? And a circle is a set of points equidistant from a center point. What you are looking at here is the representation of a circle. Because, in fact, there's width to this edge, right? In order for you to see it at all, there would have to be width to the edge. And so, in fact, a circle is a product of our imagination, right? And we use the image or the approximation of a circle on the board in order to understand the abstract concept of a circle. Does that make sense? I said this to one of my students, and he went, poof, like that. Yeah? You can't experience a perfect circle, in fact. I mean, only in idea, right? You can't experience it in the physical world because everything in the physical world has some depth, length, or width. But points do not, right? A point is just an idea. Thank you. Okay, so for Aristotle, images are 100% necessary, right? And not only can we know things through the material world, but the human person is in her nature material. This body is part of what it is to be me. Okay? If without a body, my soul cannot express itself. It has nothing to work with. Okay? So I might have some software, but I need hardware. Does that make sense? Okay? So when I think about, for instance, human action, Aristotle thinks in terms of not just intellect, but also desire, right? So Plato's like, just teach them, you know, give them the right idea of what's good. And Aristotle said, sure, you can do that, but what if they have terrible habits? So he doesn't deny the idea that I can know what's good but fail to do it because I'm weak, right? I'm unself-disciplined. Okay, so it's really a more traditional view of morality, right? You're actually guilty. Okay, you chose badly. I don't just need to re-educate you, right?
They have camps for that.
What?
They have camps for that.
They have re-education camps. Because if I'm going to rehabilitate you, I get to decide when you're ready. That's right, when you're done. Okay. And think of Aristotle's a great psychologist. He's paying a lot of attention to human emotion. Right? And think about the embodiment of our human emotion. If you're nervous, you have heat crawl up your neck, don't you? If you feel love for your child in your arms, your chest feels full. Has anyone ever experienced that? Right? You feel that fullness in your chest. If you're angry, I have a purple blot that kind of expands in front of my eyes if I'm enraged. Is that only me? It's only when students text in class. I just feel like I can't even see anymore. It's I'm so enraged. I always tell them, just don't even go there. Just don't risk it. Okay. Okay, so our bodily habits are not separable from our moral decision making. And the key virtue is self-control. All right, let's jump then to Thomas Aquinas. So Thomas Aquinas is an Aristotelian. He changes the whole game in the medieval period, right? Everybody's a Platonist up until this point. He gets the works of Aristotle. I mean, that's part of the reason why it's so important is because they only had his logic. They didn't have his other works. He gets the works, including the Islamic commentaries, and he kind of presents them to the world. And Aquinas sort of reads Aristotle and goes, hey, wait a second. Didn't we believe in the resurrection of the body? Why are we talking about the afterlife as though it's just our souls? That's weird. Sort of like we just kind of forgot about that part for a while. Okay. And so, interestingly, you see art kind of change back very quickly after that as well, right? You see the rediscovery of the classical attention to detail and perspective during the Renaissance. You know, Aquinas is writing around 1250. So it's very, very close to the Renaissance. He has a huge, huge influence, and particularly on Dante. I mean, it just sweeps Europe. Dante is a thoroughgoing Thomist. So he's an Aristotelian who's a Christian. He's a Christian Aristotelian, all right? They're bringing these two together, understanding the importance of our bodiliness, of our need for images in order to understand concepts, and the importance of art, right? Does anybody know anything about Aristotle's Poetics? What's one of the most famous concepts in art that comes from Aristotle? Catharsis, right? You've heard that term, catharsis, pity and fear, being released through experiencing it through drama, right? For Aristotle, it's absolutely socially necessary to have, and it has to be good art. And he lays out beginning, middle, and end, and how to make it most compelling, right? And how to make the plot create the character. And you can disagree with Aristotle, you know, in particular, but he's clearly a great fan of art, okay? It's very important. All right, so Thomas Aquinas influences Dante. Let's see who we've got here. Oh, boy, talk about images. Woo! Here we go. Who's read The Divine Comedy? Or bits of it? Right. Yeah, I know. I don't think I've even read the entire Paradiso, and I took a whole class on it. Dante builds the universe of The Divine Comedy on Aristotelian cosmology, Christian Aristotelian ethics. Dante the Pilgrim is the character in the poem. So there's Dante the poet who's writing the poem, and then there's Dante the Pilgrim who's in the poem. And he must traverse hell, purgatory, and heaven. It's a metaphor. It's the whole story. It's an image of the soul's journey to union with God. And the purpose of the Inferno is for Dante to face up to what sin really is. So he uses very gritty, earthy images here, right? He really wants to punch you in the gut in the Inferno, because if you don't recognize what sin is, you don't want to get rid of it in your life. You still think it's fun or cute, right? But once you start seeing Paolo and Francesca getting whipped around like that, miserably connected to each other for eternity, it's like, this doesn't look so fun after all. You know those love songs about how I'd rather go to hell with you than be, I don't know, maybe not, right? So he's got a totally... And it's the influence of the images on his emotions that's teaching him that vice is destructive and should be avoided at all costs. He has to experience it. Now, Virgil is there. Virgil is human reason, right? Virgil is there, and he's walking him through it. So human reason comes together with appropriate emotions in order to create the correct ethical response. Okay? So what sort of images are used? I mean, lust whips one in endless circles, right? It's a picture of what lust is. It just drags you around. You can't get away from it. You don't want to do it, but you're doing it, right? It's whipping you around, and that's what you see in the circle of the lustful. Treachery. This is treachery. It traps you in ice because the treacherous heart is frozen, right? What are you going to turn on your own brother? Your own cousin, your own king, that's ice cold, right? That's an abusive reason. Okay, and by the time he crawls down Satan's legs, this is him here, he's on the back of Virgil, so he's holding tight to human reason, but he's ready. He hates sin at this point. He hates it. At the beginning, he kind of felt some pity and stuff, but he gets over it. Okay. And I want to make sure I get through it here. All right, and so then, for instance, if we go to now the Purgatorio, this is the metaphor for sanctification, the sanctification process. Because I can know that something's evil and destructive, but I still don't have the habits to stop doing it. Right? Now I've just got the clarity, but I don't have the habits, and so I have to undergo certain activities. So in the realm of the prideful, because pride is always first, right? He gets down low because they're crushed under rocks, and you can sort of see it here, but here. They're crushed under rocks, and they're kind of doing around in a circle like this, right? Because what is a prideful man like? He's like this. His nose up in the air, his haughty chest, right? And so what do? You become humble. You go low. Right? And so they practice that. And Dante may have a little pride himself because he actually gets down low to talk to one of the prideful people. And these people are happy to be getting rid of this vice. They're so happy to be there. They're making progress. They hate this sin and they're just getting it out of themselves. They're purging it out of themselves. Mortification, one might call it. Okay. The images in the Purgatorio are loftier. They're a little less gritty, so they're like bas-reliefs that come to life, and or visions that appear in Dante's mind. And it's the whip and the rain. And so the whip is going to be the story of someone who has the beautiful virtue that crushes that vice. Oftentimes it's Mary. Okay. I think one of the examples is St. Nicholas, right, in the circle of the avarice, of the avaricious, the greedy, right? And St. Nicholas is giving his gold to save those young ladies. Okay, and then the rain is raining you in from the vice. So you're looking at some historical example of someone who really suffered as a result, right? What was Haman? Haman is definitely one of them. I think he might be envy or something. And so, once again, the image is affecting your willingness to pursue the virtue and rein yourself in from the vice. Does that make sense? Because it's corresponding to your emotional response. And you need that image in order to do that. And then finally, in the Paradiso, gorgeous. Many people say the Paradiso is the greatest poetic achievement of all time. Because it's so ethereal, the concepts are much harder to concretize. And people say that Dante did an amazing job. Of course, T.S. Eliot said Dante and Shakespeare divide the world between them. before he ascends into paradise, Virgil says, "Await no more a word or sign from me. Your will is straightened, free, and whole, and not to act upon its promptings would be wrong. I crown and mitre you, Lord of yourself." Right? So once those, and I thought of Martin Luther too. What did he say? Love and do what thou wilt. Right? If your emotional responses are purified, in other words, if you naturally love the good and your habits are good and it flows naturally out of you, you don't have to analyze everything to death, right? You can act on your impulses. Okay, and of course he's about to go to heaven, so that fits. And this is just absolutely gorgeous. And I put this up here. This is St. Thomas Aquinas and St. Bonaventure. Okay? And this is in one of the cantos in the Paradiso. St. Thomas Aquinas is praising St. Francis. And Bonaventure is a Franciscan. And they debated, by the way. They debated on private property. And St. Bonaventure is praising St. Dominic, right? And Thomas Aquinas is a Dominican. So what do you do in heaven? You're transparent to one another. And you're praising the other. You're happy for the other. Even the nuns who broke their vows in the very first, they're so happy for everyone who's there, right? Even though they're only at the very first level. Okay. The one way to think about the Paradiso is your sanctification is sort of like a cup, and in heaven your cup is full. Everyone is full of bliss. But some people may have bigger cups, right? Given the capacity for love that they habituated in their character. Okay, and some may have a smaller cup, but everyone's cup is full, right? Everyone is in perfect bliss. No self-consciousness, no comparison, no envy, blessing upon blessing. So what I want to contend, and I know we're coming close to our time, is that Christianity takes the middle way between rationalism and romanticism, though we sometimes get pulled one way or another. And on the one hand, we can't be romantics because we know that the corruption of this world comes not from without but from within. We believe in original sin, right? Even if we were dropped in a perfect society, we'd probably screw it up. At the same time, we can't be a rationalist. You know why? Because we look at creation and we say, it is good, it is good, it is good, it is good. We trust and follow an embodied Savior. I mean, think about this, guys. Jesus resurrects from the dead. He's not a ghost. He resurrects from the dead. He leans down. He gathers sticks. He gets some flour. He gets some oil. He goes and looks for his friends who are fishing. He starts a fire, and he makes them breakfast. I mean, think about that for a second, right? That's an embodied Savior, okay? The monasteries, I have to give a shout out to the monasteries here because even Aristotle, with his emphasis on the material world, didn't think that you could pursue the contemplative life and the active life at the same time. They're two separate lives. Okay, so first you do your political life or whatever it is, and then you go and be a priest and you do contemplation when you're old. But look what the monasteries did. They combined the two. Prayer and contemplation, along with inventing new irrigation techniques, opening hospitals, creating champagne and cheese, and raising orphans. And what did Mother Teresa say? She said, I contemplate my Lord Jesus and his love as I wash the back with the boils on it, right, of the leprosy patient, right, or something like that. So the contemplation and the action go together. Okay, so this is even more radical than what Aristotle was able to do. He wasn't able to bring them together in the way that Christianity does. I do think we need to slough off the last of our Gnosticism. And particularly with our images of heaven. This is my little soapbox. N.T. Wright is worth reading on this. We still have these medieval paintings in our mind where everyone is sort of floating or something. What are we doing in heaven? Well, we have bodies. We are ruling. We are judging. We are building, right, in a restored and renewed, a great city in which there is no sun because Jesus is its light. What an image. Okay, so I'll end there. Thank you. So we've got to go, right?
A couple questions about Curtis.
Okay, so we have been doing some interaction, but I had to rush through there. I didn't even have time to talk about the Scottish Enlightenment. Does anybody want to say anything else? Yeah.
You said you covered something about Scottish Enlightenment.
Okay, so just mention it quickly. So Hume and Smith and those guys writing the 1700s do consider themselves to be taking exception to Cartesian rationalism. Sometimes they are called romantics because of their moral sentiment theory. They think that they can base morality on human sentiments. And that's fair enough. But I do think, and I did jot this down, I do think we should consider them not quite in that category because they're very aware of human limitation. Knowledge is something that grows from generation to generation and is passed down through custom and tradition. And they also want to give a richer account of human reasonableness that includes imagination and association and custom and tradition, right? And so philosophy is not just calculative reason. That's not the only authority, right? You can appeal to a wide variety of authority. And the account of reasonableness, let's call it, is richer in the Scottish Enlightenment. And I've got to say, Hume was very prescient when it came to the real destructiveness of the utopianism that was coming. He saw what people were doing, that their rationalism was pulling them away from normal human emotional responses to ethical issues. and it would become a justification for some scary stuff. And he knew it was coming. He called it philosophical melancholy and delirium. And he thought, never in the history of the world, people have been into religion and they've been into different things, but never in the history of the world were there philosophical cults like there are in the modern era. And he saw that it would be very dangerous. And indeed it was. Bloodier than anything. And so I want to give that little shout out to them as incorporating imagination, being suspicious of rationalism, and I don't think they go all the way over to romanticism. It's not about, oh, just let it all go free. Not at all, right? Custom and tradition have a very important role to play, and they constrain you in important ways. And we need to be epistemically humble about what we can accomplish. There may be a lot of great goals, but that doesn't mean I know how to achieve them. Right? And so it's a pushback on that utopian tendency of romanticism. Does that make sense? Okay, great. Thank you for giving me a chance to do it. Anything else? Okay, good. We have like five. Oh, yes?
Sorry, I just
said, yep. Very quickly, since we're so limited on time, I will say that I have an unusual reading of Hume. I think that he is doing a kind of reductio ad absurdum of the calculative rationalists, the calculative rationalism of the Cartesian Enlightenment. And he's forcing them to admit that you have to import other things than calculative reason in order to get basic cause and effect reasoning. So he's not questioning that cause and effect is rational in a broad sense of the term rational. He's saying, if all you'll give me is 2 plus 2 equals 4 type of rationality, right, deductive rationality, you're not even going to get basic cause and effect. What are you going to do with that? You're not going to get anywhere. You're going to end in total skepticism. So he's more of a moderate skeptic who has a kind of naive realism, right? In other words, no, we just know that we make these connections and that's legitimate. Maybe it is our imagination and our powers of association that make that connection and not pure calculative reason. So it's still really, really useful, right? And so he's more of a moderate skeptic. I'm afraid he's often misinterpreted in that regard. So I'll end there. All right, great. Thank you.